Am I the only one that's sweating profusely? Yeah. I'm warm. It's warm in that corner. I need to get me a little fan or something. There you go. Daniel chapter 9. We started this chapter last week. And as far as verses go, we did the first 3/4 of it or so of the chapter. But as the content goes, or the, I don't know what word to use, I want to use seriousness of the content, but the pull of the content toward you, it's these last 3 or 4 verses that we're going to look at today. Daniel, we saw last week, was reading from the book of Jeremiah. As he's reading the book of Jeremiah in what we would know as chapter 25 and 29, he sees the Jeremiah's prophecy of the 70-year captivity of God's people. Daniel, realizing apparently that this is probably toward the end of that time of judgment, begins to pray to God. And he first prays confessing his sin. And we don't look at Daniel as being a horrible sinner, but he puts himself in the group with his people. We have sinned, he says. And that was one thing to notice. He acknowledges to God that God was righteous in judging his nation, that they had no right to expect mercy from him, but Daniel cries out and pleads for mercy. Daniel asks God to restore, you can see from the text in so many words, their homeland and the holy city of Jerusalem. Daniel says that as he was praying, that God sends an angel to him, Gabriel, and gives him insight and understanding concerning what he's praying about. And I don't know what Daniel was expecting, but I doubt if it was what he got. The angel gives him much more information than he probably was expecting. This angel gives him a bird's eye view, you might say, of the rest of the history of the world. Now, I want to talk to you just for a minute. And Conrad, would you put that first slide up there? To me, I was thinking this past week that prophecy is sort of like a picture or photograph that's out of focus. And you can look at that, whatever that is, and it appears to be out of focus, doesn't it? Does anybody know what that is?
Quarter.
What?
Quarter.
Quarter. Wrong.
Dime.
Okay. You can't tell what that is from that picture. You're guessing, right? Okay. If you keep looking at different pictures, show us the next picture, Conrad. No, not much different there, right? What about the next picture? Not much there. Next one. That's a little different, isn't it? You see different shades of dark and light in the middle. What about one more? What about that? Anybody know what that is? Silver dollar. Think so? What kind of silver dollar? There's a better name for it than that. Peace. It's a peace dollar. Anybody know where that dollar got its name? At the end of World War I, which wasn't called World War I then, it was called the Great World War, there was a big push for world peace. You remember that? The League of Nations. Some of y'all studied that in school, didn't you? And they tried to emphasize world peace because they never wanted to be another war like there just was. And this coin was made in the United States as commemorating and acknowledging that and pushing for world peace. Now you're starting to see a little detail. Okay, how many of you have never seen a peace dollar? Beverly? Who else? Jeff and Arlene, all right? Karen, some of you. Okay. The rest of you don't participate, okay? If you've never seen a peace dollar, only you can participate. Do you see anything on there that you might could recognize? You know what a coin looks like. Usually there's somebody's head on a coin, and there's usually some words here or there, and maybe a date on the one side or the other. Can you recognize anything where you think this might be something? Okay, you can see in God we trust at the bottom?
No, at the top.
At the top. In God we trust is at the top, Arlene says. She can see that. Date on the bottom, what did you say? Okay, right across that kind of line, looks like going across.
Oh, that's
I like how Leanna worded that. There might be. Y'all catch that? All right, let's do one more time. Is that any better? Not really? Huh? Liberty at the top, you can see. What's those lines going up? Coming out. Some kind of crown or headdress or something, right, you think? All right, you see a word going around the top? Can you tell what that might be? Liberty, you think? Okay. Let's do it one more time. They getting better? Now, we can tell now it's liberty, right? You can tell the lines going out from a headdress is indeed a very bizarre-looking, we might say modern-looking headdress, right? You can still see what looks like to be words across there, and it's clear that this is a date down at the bottom. Can you read the digits of the date? 1920 is what it looks like, doesn't it?
1925.
25, old Kenny, he got sharp eyes. One more time, Conrad. Okay, here is the bottom of the coin. It is indeed 1925. And what we saw going across says, in God we trust. Do you see any kind of fault in this coin? What's the fault? Do what?
Trust has a V instead of a U.
Trust has a V instead of a U. You don't know how many times, and it's not very many, that people have called me thinking I know something about coins. So, hey, I've got this silver dollar. It's got an error on it. The word trust is misspelled. It's got a V instead of a U. And they think they've got a coin worth millions of dollars or thousands of dollars. They ask me how much I would give it for. Give them for it. And let's suppose that this coin is worth $20. $20 to $30 is what it's worth. And I tell them, you know, if the coin is worth $20, $30, and I tell them that's not an error. Every coin that year or in the Peace Dollar series was made, that's the font style that they use in making a U. It looks like a V. I would not buy that coin from somebody for $20 or $30. I wouldn't give you $50 or $60 for them. And here's the reason. They think it's worth $5,000. And they think if I give them $60, which is twice what it's worth, they think I'm cheating them. So I say, you know, you keep your coin. I see them often enough, you know, You just keep it. Maybe it is worth $5,000. I don't know. Anyway, here's the point I want to make from this. This is not a coin collecting lesson. But as you looked at that first blurry thing, when it first, some of you have different degrees of knowledge about coins. When it first became questionable to you, or the thought came to your head, this looks like it might be a coin. Some of you who are familiar with this dollar recognized what it was before others of you did. Some of you never recognized it at all because you've never seen one. And it's sort of that way in studying Scripture. It's sort of that way in studying prophecy. If you don't know much about prophecy, and you don't know much about what the Bible teaches about these things from other books of the Bible, then when we read what we're going to read in Daniel this morning, it's probably going to all be pretty new to you. But if you're familiar with the things about prophecy in other areas of the Bible, particularly the book of Revelation, we're going to be reading some things more, and you're going to go, aha, I've heard that before somewhere else in the Bible. And it is also possible that someone may look at what we've study today and come up with thinking they've got a V instead of a U. Or they can get way off base because they mistake something dramatically. Everybody following me? Okay, so keep all that in mind as we go through our text today. I'll give you a quote. This comes from Barnes Notes. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Barnes Notes, but he's quoting a guy whose name was Stewart. And this professor, Stewart, says this, and this is going to be a paraphrase because I can't pronounce all the words he uses and much less kind of understand what they mean. So I'm going to give you the Pine Snag version. Okay? He says this, it would require, he's talking about these four verses, it would require a volume of considerable magnitude, even to give a history of the ever-varying and contradictory opinions of critics respecting this text. Everybody follow that? If you were to write a book and explain all the opinions that everyone has concerning these four verses, it'd be a thick book. He goes on. And perhaps an even larger book to establish an exegesis or an explanation which would stand. In other words, which would stand up to the critique of anybody who wanted to critique this explanation. If you were to write a book that explained it all in such a way and showed the fallacies of any other view and all this kind of stuff, it would require a thick book to do that. He says, I am fully of the opinion that no interpretation as yet published will stand the test of thorough grammatical historical criticism. This was written probably over 100 years ago, I suppose. That a candid and searching and thorough critique here in this text is still something to be desired. Now, I figure 45 minutes is long enough for us to get this settled, reckon? So let's see what we've got. I want to look at key elements in this text. Now let's read the text to begin with. We're going to start at verse 24 of Daniel chapter 9. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. All right, I don't know what that sounds like to you, but if I were to sum it up, I would have to say it doesn't sound good. It sounds confusing. It sounds like I'm not sure what's going on here, but I know one thing, it doesn't sound good. Now, I want to talk about just some key elements that's in this passage to begin with. The first one is found in the first two words, 70 weeks. That word weeks in the Hebrew word simply means a period of seven. Okay, some of your translation, I think the NIV is one that tells you or translates the word 77s. Some other translations may say 70 periods of seven. I think the New American Standard says 70 weeks. This is the New King James that I'm using. It says 70 weeks. The King James says 70 weeks. So what is this? Okay, the word weeks also means a period of seven. Okay, we look at the word week to mean Sunday through Saturday. But it's really, the word means a period of seven. Could be 7 minutes, could be 7 months, it could be 7 years, 7 days, whatever the case may be. The context will tell you what it means. Most often, when you read the word weeks in the scriptures, now I shouldn't say most often because that's not the case. Most often when it's used and obviously questionable as to whether or not it means a literal Sunday through Saturday week, most often it's going to mean a year. Each of those sevens is a year long. So a week is a 7 years. Everybody follow me? The most memorial or the most thing that we might remember the best from the Old Testament history, the narrative of the Old Testament, remember when Jacob goes to Laban and he sees his daughters and he wants to marry Rachel. He falls in love with Rachel. And so Laban says, if you work for me 7 years, then you can marry Rachel. Well, he works for her 7 years, and what happens? He's fooled. He gives him Leah, the older sister, to marry first, or to marry. He discovers he's been fooled, and he's a little upset. Imagine that. He's upset, and so he asks, he says, listen, I'm in love with Rachel. I want to marry Rachel. And Laban says these words, fulfill her week also, and you can marry her. It's obvious from the context that doesn't mean next Saturday. It means 7 years, just like you worked 7 years for the first one. You'll work 7 years or fulfill her week also, and you can marry her. Okay, so when we see the word week in this text, and I'm going to use the word week rather than seven or periods of seven, because as you study this subject, you're going to see that word used a lot. So get yourself familiar with it. 70 weeks is 70 periods of 7 years each, or 490 years. In this text, you see 70 weeks mentioned. You see in verse 25, 7 weeks mentioned. You see 62 weeks mentioned. And later on over there, you see 1 week mentioned. Now, it's easy to see. You don't even need a calculator, I don't think. Hope not. That 7 plus 62 plus 1, those individual weeks that are mentioned, add up to what? 70. Do you suppose that the addition of all those things is the same 70 as in verse 24, 70 weeks are determined? And some people would say, not necessarily. And I would agree that it's not necessarily. But you'd have a hard press to convince me that that's not the same number. 62 plus 7 plus 1 just happens to equal 70, which he's already talked about. I'm of the opinion that it's the same 70. So that's an element. Then the next thing that is not as prominent as probably maybe God meant it to be, but is this word determined or decreed? We kind of gloss over that and we kind of read through it because we're looking at those numbers and we're looking at all these desolations and all these things. But he says 70 weeks are determined or are decreed. Decreed by who? Come on. Decreed by who? God. Y'all not afraid to talk, are you? Let's say it. Decreed by who? There we go. Decreed by God, 70 weeks are determined. Going over there and look in the end of verse 26, the end shall be like a flood, he says, until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Desolations are determined by who? God. You go on down to the last of the last verse, even the consummation, which is determined or decreed by who? God. All these things that Gabriel is showing Daniel have been determined by God. Now, that's the key elements that we're going to find in this text that will kind of be in the background or kind of maybe not so much in the background as we go through the text. I want to talk first about a general prophecy. This is only verse 24. We're going to look at just verse 24. 70 weeks, 70 times 7 is 490. So you got 490 years are determined. At the end of which, six things will be accomplished. Now, I don't think that this demands that they are accomplished that day. It means they will have been accomplished by the time we get to 490 years, or the 77s. Everybody with me? So let's see what these six things are. First one, and you fill in the blanks, to finish the transgression. 70 weeks, God says, and God has determined to finish the transgression. What is that talking about, do you think? You may want to guess? Do what? Israel's sin. Okay? This is sort of like that fuzzy picture, isn't it? Okay? We're looking at this fuzzy picture. And we see this to finish the transgression. We think of transgression, we think of sin. We think of Israel's sin, perhaps because he's talking about 70 weeks are determined for your people, Daniel's people, who were the Israelites. Okay? To finish the transgression. To finish the transgression. Okay, when I read that, I think of totally stopping it. It's over. All right? When would Israel's transgression be totally over, or anyone's transgression be totally over? At the end of time, perhaps, when Jesus comes again? Be what I would think. The second one, to make an end of sin. So far, we know that doesn't mean 2021, because I still see sin around. To make an end of sins, what does that mean? And when will that take place? Or has it taken place? When did it take place? To make an end of sins. At the judgment? After the judgment? Okay, like in the future? Okay, when Christ comes back and judges the world, okay, I would think that's what most people would say would be the case. The third one, to make reconciliation for iniquity. What would that be? When Jesus dies, maybe? When Jesus is crucified? Or then that would be, we would tend to look at it as where that was where reconciliation was made, but there's also a sense in which our reconciliation might, in a sense, we might say it is complete later on when Christ comes back and we receive it in its fullness and our bodies are changed, et cetera, et cetera. To bring in everlasting righteousness. Has that taken place yet? I don't think so. Does anybody think everlasting righteousness is here? No. Again, that seems to look forward to a time when Jesus comes again and the world is changed, the new heaven and a new earth, and righteousness is all that there is. To seal up vision and prophecy, to finish that, not seal it up as in keep you from looking at it, but to finish it, complete it, to end it. And the last one, to anoint the most holy. Who is the most holy? Jesus Christ. When could we say that Jesus was anointed? On earth? He was anointed on earth. You remember when God appeared at the baptism of John the Baptist, said, "This is my beloved son." He had anointed him for his ministry on the earth. It could also be a future reference as well, but it's obviously a reference to Jesus. Now, if your translation says most holy place, that's a word that's added in that someone has taken to think that it means a place and not a person. Okay, so you got these six things. 70 weeks are determined or decreed to do these things. And for the most part, they look at as if there are things that are only going to be accomplished when Christ comes again. Okay, so we've got in this verse 70 weeks. That's time. Time has a starting point and an ending point. These 70 weeks have a starting point and an ending point. In verse 24, you do not see a starting point. But you do see an ending point. That ending point is whenever these six things are accomplished, which I take to be when Christ comes again. Okay, everybody following me? Okay. Can we get a clearer picture of the starting point or the ending point of these 70 weeks other than from this verse? This verse is a general statement of the prophecy that he's giving. And then, beginning in verse 25 through 27, he gives a particular explanation or interpretation of the prophecy. Now, this is common in the Old Testament, very common. You see it in the account of the creation in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. God tells us the general account, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, and then he backs up and he tells that sixth day in much more detail. And we see the same thing. We saw it in Exodus somewhere, and I can't remember where it was at that we saw it as we were going through that, but we see it here as well. First, verse 24, 70 weeks are determined until the end. And all these things are accomplished. Now in verse 25, he begins to go into more detail about those 70 weeks. So let's look at that. He says in verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem." So there is our starting point. From the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That is a total of 69 weeks. Now, I assume, I'm going to say some assumptions that I make. A lot of this stuff I'm not going to be dogmatic about because I know there are other explanations to some of the stuff. But I assume that the 7 weeks, the 62 weeks, and the 1 week, there are no overlap in those weeks. So that they, if you butt them all together, they cover 70 weeks. Okay, I also assume that the decree to rebuild Jerusalem is the starting point of the 70 weeks that Gabriel is telling him about. One thing I do wonder about is why is the 7 weeks broke off from the 62? Right, he says in verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks." Why not just say there shall be 69 weeks? All right. There are explanations for that that people have been given. One of them that may sound plausible, may not. But some people say that the 7 weeks, the next phrase goes with that. After the 7 weeks, the street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. And they can go to look at how long it took to rebuild the wall and Jerusalem, and it supposedly was 49 years. So you've got those 7 weeks there. I don't know. I know that there was troublous times for the people who came to rebuild the wall. You can read the book of Nehemiah and see that. All right? This was accomplished. See on the back of the next page there. They say this was accomplished around 396 B.C., which ironically, or perhaps providentially, was the end of Old Testament prophecy, the book of Malachi. Now, I don't see anything in this text that wants to make that part of the issue here, but I don't know. All right? But it is very clear why he mentions the 62 weeks, or it is to me. At that time, he says, the Messiah shall be cut off at the end of the 62 weeks. Or this would be at the total of the end of 69 weeks. Who is the Messiah, and in what way will he be cut off? I'll call on names. The Messiah is Jesus Christ. He's cut off when he was killed on the cross. Okay, that's what comes to my mind to start with. Is it yours? Okay. Till the Messiah comes. That makes me think of Jesus coming. Till the Messiah is cut off. That makes me think automatically that of his crucifixion when he was killed. All right? I think of no other alternatives to that thought, to that interpretation. Maybe there is, but it just seems to me to be hard to refute. What other phrase in our text supports that idea, that this is a reference to Jesus' crucifixion? The next phrase right after that, he says, and after the 62 weeks, verse 26, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. What does that make you think of? That he didn't die for himself, did he? He died for us. He died for someone else, but not for himself, but for others, for someone else. So this makes me think that this is a reference to Jesus' crucifixion. Now, the point down there says, it can be shown that the time between the decree and the death of Christ was 69 weeks. Now, you have to do a little work here to see the possibilities, because there were three decrees that were given, not all in the same year. And so do your own study if you want to study and to hone in on that. But the first decree was not to rebuild Jerusalem. It was simply to rebuild the temple. So if you don't count that one for that reason, and plus it ends up being, 20 or 30 years too early. The second and the third decrees are a little different in time. And I don't forgot how much, maybe a year or two. I can't remember. But they end up a little different. But when you, in one of them, if you, or maybe both of them, if you convert the years from our years to 360-day years like they used back then, and add the year for zero, which is not included, and take off the 3 or 4 years the error that's in our calendar compared to when Jesus died or was born, when you make all those corrections, you come just pretty doggone close. I mean, within a year, all right? One of the passages in, I think it's in Ezra or Nehemiah, but one of those edicts gives the month as Nisan and the day, which would correspond to the same day of Passover. So it is very plausible that this prophecy is exactly right. Now, I can't prove it. I'm taking somebody's word for it. But we see what the scriptures say here. Okay. Where are we at? Okay, so the rest, okay, this is that point. I should have numbered those points. The rest of verse 26 and all of verse 27 is out of focus for me. Okay. I read this, and like, for instance, verse 26, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. When I first read that, I think of 70 AD when Titus destroys Jerusalem. And I think that's by far, in my mind, the best explanation. Until the end of the war, or the end of it shall be like a flood. Now, here's a thought that you ought to keep in mind. That this is saying that the end of all this desolation that's going on, it comes and goes like a flood. Have you ever been in a flood? Okay. It brings to my mind the type of flood that you don't just gradually see the water rise. It comes pouring down a gorge or something, and the water rises quickly, and you have no warning. And I have come to believe that the end of the time, and when the bad things come, when desolations happen, and perhaps tribulation and persecution is upon us, that it will happen very speedily. There will be very little warning. We can sit here nowadays and talk about this that looks like this, and that that looks like that, and this and that, but one day it's going to sweep through, and we're going to be, caught right in it. It will sweep through, it will come in like a flood, and it will be gone and over. And it will be over. All right. But the end of it should be like a flood. This, I just said, seemed like 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem. Till the end of war, desolations are determined. Now, I guess I have this hang up. Every time I see the word desolations, I think of something in Revelation. And I think of something in time. All right. So I'm sitting here thinking of 70 AD, and then there's a word, this word that makes me think of the end of time. So I find myself trying to go back and forth. In verse 27, then he shall confirm a covenant. Who is he? Well, it looks like it's that prince up there that's going to destroy the city. He's going to confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Now, this doesn't even come close to telling us who he is. It doesn't come close to telling us what the covenant is about or who he's making the covenant with. It does tell us it does for 1 week. And I know enough about Revelation to know this sounds familiar to something I have read before in Revelation, don't you? Okay. And in the middle of the week, there we are again. I read something about that somewhere. I mean, this picture is not quite as blurry as the coin picture was for me. But it's still a little blurry. And it goes on, and it reads like, sometimes it reads like 70 AD. Sometimes it seems like it could be the end of time and the time of the tribulation. I don't know. That term, the middle of the week, of this 1 week, which is 7 years, that middle of the week is going to be 3.5 years, right? We've seen that back in chapter 7, where he talks about a time, times, and half a time, right? In Revelation, you see two times a mention of 42 months. Another time, you see a mention of 1,260 days, which, using 360 for a year, is 3.5 years or 42 months. It is highly unlikely, in my mind, that this middle of the week and whatever we read in Revelation are not the same thing. You'll have a hard time convincing me that whatever week he's talking about here in Daniel 9 and whatever week we read about in the book of Revelation are not the same thing. You'll have a hard time convincing me that the 42 months we see in the book of Revelation, whatever it means there, it means the same here. You'll have a hard time convincing me otherwise. So, some people see, most or not all of this is being fulfilled around 70 AD. Some see a double fulfillment being in 70 AD and immediately prior to the Lord's return. I'm just not sure. A lot of this is just out of focus for me. Now, I'll talk a little bit about numerology and symbolism. Here's a question. Are numbers used symbolically in the Scriptures? Yes, 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 yes. I see lots of yeses. Okay? If so, who determines what numbers represent? God. I see a God. Okay. If that's the case, why is it that some people would say a certain number represents this, someone else would say that same number represents something else? Can you show me, and this is sort of a challenge, but can you show me in the Scriptures where the number 40 represents testing. Where God said, I'm using 40 as a representation of testing. Can you show me that? I can show you where Jesus was tempted in the wilderness for 40 days. I can show you where the children of Israel came across the wilderness. It took them 40 years to get there. And we get that idea from those events. But where does God say, I'm using this number to represent this? Okay? In that way, excuse me for correcting you, Lori, that idea doesn't come from God. It comes from somebody interpreting the Scripture. And now it might be that God meant it that way as well, but He didn't tell us that, or I hadn't seen it. And I looked up, you can find books, thick books, on numerology, what all numbers mean in the Bible. I found that the number 7 means completeness, totality of it. Number 7. I found that the number 12 means completeness, totality. I found that the number 10 means completeness and totality. See where I'm going with this? Okay. Number 5 means grace. You know why it means grace? Because there are 10 commandments, and the 10 commandments have 2 groups of 5. I'm not catching that. Okay? All right? If you want to mystify the Bible with making numbers mean something, then go ahead. But you can end up in chaos. You can end up in la-la land in a hurry. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that some numbers do not represent things symbolically in the Scriptures. Some people look at our text, and this is where I'm going with this, as 70 weeks as a symbolic representation. And the idea is that 7 is a number that represents completeness, and 70 just magnifies that idea that it's complete. And so you've got, between point A and point B, you've got this indeterminate amount of time between point A, which is the decree to rebuild the temple, and point B, which is when Christ comes and puts an end to all these things. But it's an indeterminate number of years. And that's a prophecy. I don't mean to be disrespectful or smartly. I'm not being that way, especially in regard to the fact that I may be wrong, and God knows. But I don't see anything prophetic about that. If I were to tell Arlene that between your birth on this earth and the day you die on this earth, everything in between there is a totality of your life, would you say, wow, what a prophet he is? No, you wouldn't. And that's what it looks like these 70 weeks are. It's a time period that they say is indefinite for this to be accomplished, but we already know that it's going to be accomplished between this point and the end of time. So, but what if those 70 weeks are really to be taken literally? What if they really are 490 years? And we are told by God that there's 490 years between the decree of the temple and the point when all these things is put to an end and completed at the return of Christ. That's 490 years. Now that's a prophet. Or that's a prophecy, right? It's something that I can't foresee. It's something that I've never seen before. You know, it's not something that's common. But what's the problem with that? The problem is, that's about 2,000-3,000 years ago. Okay? Now, I know the explanations that are given, that there's a parenthesis that is between the 69th week and the 70th week. That's the church age, et cetera, and all that. I know that. But to me, that seems like the Achilles heel of that explanation. And maybe it's not. But it just seems like there's a weakness there that I want to acknowledge that's there. Okay? Now, I'll give you some final thoughts here. Have you ever changed your mind about something you believe?
Yes.
Really? Once or twice? Okay. I have. I know some people, Christian people that know the Scriptures very well, that as far as I can tell, they hadn't changed their mind about anything ever. They had it right from the very get-go, and God bless them. That's right. Okay? Yeah. I'm not that way. There are a few instances where I have had, and that's the word of emphasis, I've had to change my mind about something the Bible taught. I didn't want to change my mind about it. It's like I told y'all before years ago in a sermon, I was drug kicking and screaming from this view to this view about whatever it was. But I had to do it if I was going to be honest with myself and with the Scriptures. There are other things that I've changed my mind on in the Scriptures that I just woke up one day and realized, hey, I don't believe that anymore. When did I quit believing that? And I couldn't give you a particular point of time that I did. But I just realized, hey, usually it happened like this. I found myself defending this particular view. And I realized, hey, I'm not, because, you know, I like to argue. I like to debate. And sometimes I will be the devil's advocate and take something that I don't even believe to, you know, just to stir up a hornet's nest a little bit, all right? But this time, I find myself taking a view that I wouldn't have acknowledged that I believe, and then suddenly I realize in the middle of it, I'm not telling these people something I don't believe. I believe this. I grew up as a Baptist for the most part, all of the part until I was 30 years old, I suppose. And every church that I was in was a premillennial church, pre-tribulation rapture group of people. And I don't know, I never listened to Christian comedians. Not because I got anything against them, I just ain't my thing. But I was listening to a guy that was a comedian, and he was talking about the church he grew up in was that way. And then they got a new preacher. And the new preacher didn't believe in the pre-tribulational rapture. He believed he was going to go through the rapture. And so he said, our family just got up and went across the road to another church that believes in the pre-tribulation rapture. And he goes on, he says, you know, I feel sorry for those folks, because all they had to do to go into pre-trib rapture was cross the street and go to a different church. You know, he's being funny. All right, but I grew up in that kind of church. And somewhere along the way, I became to realize that I'm just really not sold on this pre-trib rapture deal. I just really don't see it enough that I'm going to die on that hill. At all. That's an example of what I'm talking about here. Some thoughts. God has decreed everything that will come to pass, even the desolation by a wicked people upon his own people. Are you thinking about that? God has decreed the desolation, I'm talking about a localized event in the specific year or throughout history. But God, if there is God's people face desolation, they do it because God has decreed it. Read the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk tells God, he says, God, what's going on? I see injustice all around me. And he's talking about within Israel, within Judah. I see this injustice all around me. How long are you going to let this go on? And God tells him, not long. Because I'm going to send the Chaldeans, and they're going to take care of it for me. They're going to execute judgment upon your people. And Habakkuk says, what? The Chaldeans? They're worse than we are. What does God tell him? They are. And when they get through destroying your people, I'll judge them for doing it. I believe that. I believe that God does those kinds of things. You can think it's harsh. You can think it's unfair. You can think it's wrong. You can think all you want to think about it. But the Scriptures repeatedly tell us those kinds of things. Another thing, this is just sort of a little side note type thing. Care should be taken to not state something as fact regarding end time prophecy that the Bible doesn't clearly spell out. I talked about pre-trib rapture. Let me just use that as an example. What is the difference between these two statements? The Bible doesn't teach that Christians will go up in a rapture before the 7-year tribulation starts. The Bible does not teach that. Between that statement, what's the difference between that statement and this statement? I believe that the Bible doesn't teach that the rapture will occur before the tribulation. You see the difference? All right? I'm stating one as a fact, telling you the Bible says this. The other, I'm telling you what I believe. Now, that doesn't mean just because we stick the word believe in there that what I believe is just as valid as what you believe, is just as valid as what somebody else believes. No, that's not the case. Because only one thing is true. It's just that I cannot positively state the Bible says this. Okay? I can positively state this, that God has not appointed us to wrath. Okay? I can state that as a fact. Why? Because the Bible says that. Right? So be careful how many things you state as being facts that the Bible doesn't clearly state. And there ought to be a little leeway, a little wiggle room. Okay, in an extra-biblical manner, that is long ago been standard procedure for evolution. Evolution is not represented as a theory. When's the last time you heard anybody say the theory of evolution? No, it's fact, supposedly. Now, last statement is this. I don't know if this to be true or not true. See, here I am, not stating it as fact. But it's possible that God doesn't intend for everything about end time prophecy to be in focus. For me, for you, for Daniel, for anybody else, at any time, anywhere, forever. Or till the end of time. It may be that there are things that God has intentionally given us a view that is a little bit out of focus. And what we tend to want to do, everybody goes through this prophecy phase, don't you? You know, you kind of, it's all you can think about, all you can talk about, all you can read about. Okay? And we want to hone in on every little minor detail and cross every I and dot every T and know exactly what everything is. It may be that we cannot do that. It just may be that God has left this thing fuzzy enough that we just can't answer every question. Now, maybe that's a cop-out for me. I don't know, but that's where I'm at. All right? Daniel chapter 9. I told you two weeks ago, or last week, that this chapter, and in particular these last four verses, has been called the backbone of biblical prophecy. And I can see why. Because it gives us a general look at the history of the world that is very general, four verses. And yet, everything that we might ever would know about the world ought to be able to sit in there comfortably. We're just not going to be able to know where, perhaps. Let's pray.